Sir Cliff Richard on the programme now. In 2014, his world was turned upside down when he became the subject of a long-running South Yorkshire police investigation that centred on sexual abuse allegations made by four men dating between 1958 and 1983. Sir Cliff Richard is an innocent man. He is now trying to rebuild his life after what happened to him. Sir Cliff has been making music since the 1950s. Let's not forget about this. Has had countless hits with over 100 albums and a career many would envy. I spoke to him earlier and asked him how his career began. But first, here's a blast of one of his best known Christmas hits. Christmas time.
Good morning to you, Stephen.
Good morning. I was looking through some stuff about you before this interview. My goodness, your first single released in August 1958, a long time ago, sir.
I know, yeah, it was. I mean, the funny thing is, when I look back now, I was just looking through some old books I had. I'm trying to sort of clear my life of stuff that I don't need anymore. And I found this little tiny book, and it said The Complete Works of Shakespeare. When I opened it up, it said... Jessens Secondary Modern School, presented to H. Webb for drama, and it was in 1957. Now, isn't it funny? I was still at school in 1957 towards the end, and by April or May 58, I had recorded Move It, my first record. And, of course, it wasn't released till August, and it was on my birthday in October that it became number two in the British charts. So it has and always will have a very, very... warm spot in my heart. Come on, pretty baby, let's move it and groove
it. Yeah, at what point did you become driven and ambitious and want to make it? Was it early on? Was it even then?
But you know what? I always thought it was when I heard Elvis, and I'm sure that was the main thrust of inspiration that I received. But I got a letter from a woman in Australia when I was touring there some years back now, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and she said, I just thought you might be interested. This is a letter you wrote to me. And I thought, I don't normally write letters to people. And she sent me the letter, and sure enough, there was a time when in schools in England, maybe it happens still today, where they encourage pupils to have a pen pal so you get used to writing letters. And I'd written it. She sent me this letter that I wrote to her. It said, my name is Harry Roger Webb. I go to Jessens Secondary Modern School. And my ambition is to be a famous singer. And I am 12 and a half years old. Now, I don't remember. Stephen, I don't remember at 12 and a half even writing that letter. But there it was in black and white. And I thought, wow, I did have an ambition quite early. But the advent of Elvis... and Little Richard and Buddy Holly and the Everly Brothers, Ricky Nelson, those people, I think, awoke something in our generation. And we'll never be able to get past that fact. The fact that it may have been an American art form, but it didn't belong to them in the end. And we were all influenced by it and all lived by it for so long.
Were you...
myself, the Shadows, the Beatles, everybody.
Were you a confident child?
No, I was shy in that respect. I can remember whenever my mother had her family or my father had family coming down for the weekends, for instance, or coming down for an afternoon, and they'd say, go on, Harry, sing them a song. And I, you know, I couldn't do it. I said, no, I can't do it. I couldn't do it. And yet the funny thing is, the very first thing I did once I made that record, I got on a bus with a whole lot of people I didn't know or had never met before, including the Kalin twins, whose record I had bought, and Eddie Calvert, and a whole bunch of other people. And we went on the road, and we played to a couple of thousand people a night, and I was wiggling about on stage. But I couldn't do it at home when I was an amateur. I was just too shy and embarrassed.
We're all going on a summer holiday. More working for a week or two. Fun and laughter on a summer holiday. No more worries for me or you.
And then, of course, the crazy life that I guess success brings. It's not a normal life. It's a life on the road. It's a life with a lot of pressure. How did you handle it in your 20s?
loved it, to be honest with you. I'd never even left home before that first tour in 58. And so it was like a huge adventure. Yes, I did have a couple of friends who were in my band. We were a band together at school, the drummer and the guitarist. And I picked up during that tour. I had found Hank, Marvin, and Bruce Welsh. So there were four of us together, and we knew each other, so I wasn't on my own. So we had company, and we sort of socialized together. And then during that tour, Jet Harris, the bass player, he said, "I prefer the music you're playing. Do you mind if I sit in with you?" And we went, "No, please sit in." So it was a strange thing. I didn't mind going on the road and being off. It was only a two-week period, of course. After that, there was a period where the Shadows and I, for about 3 years, must have done, 150, 200 concerts a year. And it's a different world. But, you know, if you want that, if your heart's desire suddenly happens and it happens to you, you just swing with it. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time. I have great, great memories of being with the Shadows. We were funny together. We played good music together. It was just a fun time. So, yeah, I agree with you. This world of ours is a very different type of world, and you need to have good friends around you just to keep your feet on the ground. Somebody who's not afraid to stay on, get off your high horse. Just because the girls are screaming, don't think too much of yourself. You know, so therefore you need to have some kind of solidarity. And, of course, I think I was lucky in that I had a solid family behind me too.
Is it a lonely world, Cliff? That you're there and you're on the stage and you've all of these fans, but actually, you know, when that's done, when the gig is done, that goes away. Is it a lonely world?
No, it wasn't for me. I was never lonely. Now you've mentioned it, you know, you're on stage. Yes, in the end, when you're on stage, you're on your own, except I wasn't. I was with the Shadows. And at that early stage, for instance, Hank and Bruce would be right and left of me. Jet Harris would be behind me, Tony Meehan on the drums, and often we would talk with each other. We would have jokes that we sometimes planned and sometimes happened spontaneously. So I never felt ostracized in any way. And all I know is that when the show was over, we went for a good chicken curry and chips. I'd get back to the hotel or whatever. In fact, in the early days, we couldn't afford to stay in hotels. We stayed in bed and breakfast places. So very often we'd share rooms. We sometimes shared beds. There was no way around it. So you never were on your own. And I just enjoyed the chat, the patter that went on. And so I can understand how it could be. I've often wondered whether Michael Jackson would have been better off, God bless him, you know, mingling with taking the band out for dinner every night or something like that. You know, just being with other people rather than go back to the hotel room and not talk to anybody.
I guess
I can understand that might be a tough way to deal with things.
I guess what I was hinting at within the question is, did you put your career above having someone for you, above love, above marriage?
I suppose in a way I was married to my career. There's no doubt about that. I gave it preference. I prioritized it. I was never going to let anything get in the way of spoiling it, that's for certain, and I was always going to work hard at it. I have found longevity, and that wasn't obvious at the beginning.
And
we were written off as one-hit wonders, etc. So you have to have that ambition to be what you began, and I had that ambition. And so although it didn't cut out relationships, and I have fantastic friends now. In fact, I have more friends now than I remember having in those days, because my original friends, like the Shadows, they broke up. I suddenly woke up one day, 10 years on, and I didn't have a band anymore. But, you know, I found other bands. And as I say, I mentioned that about Michael Jackson. I make it a point of socializing with my singers, with my band, with the crew.
You
sit and have a meal with them before the show even sometimes, although I don't eat too much before a show.
And that's socializing, but with the benefit of hindsight, and granted, it is with the benefit of many years of hindsight now.
Yeah.
Do you regret not having found someone for you? Not having married?
No, not really. I got close to it twice. But I'm now, when I look back at it, I'm thinking, I'm glad I didn't do it, because obviously it wasn't going to last for me. And therefore, I would not only upset myself, but I would have hurt somebody else too. So when I look back on it now, I think, as you say, with hindsight, it's easy to say. You know, I wanted to be married the minute all the shadows got married. I felt different. And so so there's no doubt in my mind, like every young man, I thought, my wife and children. But it wasn't for me. And I now when I look back, I think even now I benefit from the fact that I can actually plan a life that's not going to hurt anybody. It's not going to take me away from anyone.
Because I guess with this terrible time that you went through and these horrible false allegations that were made against you, it would have been nice. Yeah. It would have been nice to have someone by your side.
I had God with me the whole time. No one could be closer. I was just talking with somebody about this. They said they'd lost their faith in God. And I said, I thank God that I maintained my faith. Because, you know, even if you've got good friends, and I had friends with me almost that first year, I was in Portugal when the news broke. I mean, I heard it on television. I didn't even know what it was all about. But fortunately for me, I had friends that came almost the whole of the summer that year. I had friends staying with me. But you know what, Stephen? In the end, people say, good night, see you tomorrow, and then you're on your own.
Yeah.
And that's when I realized that, oh, my goodness, if I hadn't a faith, I would have had nobody to talk to. And it just was, I mean, for me, fantastic. My faith is stronger now in God than it was before that.
In those moments when you were on your own, what can you put words to how it feels when those horrible things are being said about you around the world?
I do try to put it in words. I went to speak at the House of Lords some weeks back now, and I had to start off by saying that, in actual fact, this is the truth. I don't have the vocabulary to be able to express completely how it feels. And then when I spoke with Paul Gambaccini, who had also been through a similar experience.
I would be friendly with Paul. Paul's a good man, and we've talked about
a great man.
What happened to him.
He helped me a lot. He said to me really early on, he said, you know what, the thing about it is, he said, unless you have been through it, nobody can know what we've been through. I wouldn't wish it on my enemy to have to go through something that we went through. It was just the most despairing, despondent, depressing time. And what's happening to me now, for instance, is incredibly therapeutic because, I mean, I've been welcomed back onto all the big radio shows and TV shows. You're talking to me. I mean, I've talked to so much radio and television now, and they are pleased to have me. And I, in the midst of my despair, my worry was, and this coming back to my ambitions and that sort of thing, I kept thinking to myself, how do I get back to where I was as a person? As an artist, but, you know, I felt that everything had been kind of destroyed.
But something inside you must...
false accusations.
Something
but,
inside you,
know,
Cliff.
It's therapeutic now, and I'm feeling much, much better. It's in the past for me now.
Something
I'll never get over it, but it's in the past, and I can aim at the future.
Something inside you must change forever. It's got to.
I don't know about changing, but certainly that area where you get rid of bad things, this bad thing I don't think is going to go away. I'm going to always remember it, because one of the painful parts of it for me was, why would anybody do this to another human being? I can't say that I've never met that original accuser, because my lawyers have said to me, never say you've never met somebody, because I have been photographed with thousands of people and their children, and I could well have had a picture taken at a stage door. So, but I know one thing. I'm sure that I don't know that person. And why someone would do that to another human being is a confusion to me. And I don't know whether any would be able to explain why they did it. So I'll never forget it.
It was my lifelong ambition to work for the BBC, and here I am. And I admire this organisation. I admire the integrity it has.
So do I.
Well, that was my question. How do you really feel about the BBC? Because you're suing the BBC. How do you feel about the organisation?
The litigation is strictly about the gross intrusion of privacy that was upon me, conducted by the South Yorkshire Police and the BBC hierarchy. I mean, I have nothing. I listen to the Today programme. I listen to the Archers. Anywhere I am in the world, you can get it all on the iPad now. The institution at its work level. I have nothing against the programmers, the producers, the presenters. I mean, it's fantastic, and that's why I'm saying I love the fact that they've all invited me back there. And it only goes to show that none of them believed the accusations either. They've made me feel so welcome. No, no, the litigation, and I can't speak too much about it, is just with the hierarchy.
But given the fact that Parliament has not given anonymity to people accused of sexual crimes, what was the BBC to do, Cliff? You were a worldwide star, and this was a story. What did you expect them to do?
I can't talk about this, I'm afraid. I have lots of words to tell you, but because we're in litigation, I cannot go any further than what I've just said. I feel comfortable in the fact that we will sue and win or lose, and I've already told my business manager this has nothing to do with money. This has to do with trying to stop this happening to other people. There is a rule that the police had to follow, and they didn't follow it.
Sir Cliff, let's talk about the future and what you do. Because what you do is sing, and you sing really well.
Thank you. Well, I mean, it's nice to have started after the terrible 2 years to have an album that's in the charts. And I still, coming back to what I believe about myself, it's still very hard for me to cope with the fact that my record is in the top five. And there were two or three, you know, young people up there with their albums. And I'm thinking, after 58 years, I'm still able to compete. I may not win the battle to number one all the time, but just getting into the top 10 is a miracle for me. I would say, you know, some people don't realize only one person that I know has had a top 10 album every year for 25 years, and that was Daniel O'Donnell. And none of us will ever do it. So I still find myself pleasantly surprised.
Why does it matter anymore, though? You've had so many successes in terms of albums. Why want another one? That's just greedy.
Oh, it's just like asking an artist to stop painting, or a journalist to stop writing, or you to stop asking questions. It would be ridiculous. Why would you stop asking questions?
And is this particular album, Cliff, special to you? Because it's a story of not just, I guess, survival from what's happened to you, but you're back doing what you do. Is that why this is special?
I think the music is special. This is the second album of rock and roll, iconic rock and roll songs that I've recorded, and I find myself very comfortable in that area. That generation of singers was the reason why I and the Beatles and others like us got started. So I'm always grateful for that. But I find when I'm singing that kind of material, even when I play through, once you've done the album, I play it quite a lot to try and learn some of the songs, I can recognize how comfortable I was when I recorded them all. It was like, I feel comfortable in that kind of music. And so therefore, if other people are brought back wonderful memories of a very honest and perhaps a little more naive time, that's a thrill for me too.
You'll be touring in 2017. Gloria Honeyford and I will both be falling out with you because no Northern Ireland date at present, sir. You've got to fix that.
I know. I don't know how to do that because I don't pick the venues. You know, usually the promoters, I know that we tried to get places and we couldn't find halls at the time of our dates. And, of course, that's always going to be a problem. You know, you pick a time and say, OK, I can work through June. And, of course, if there's not a venue available in June, and maybe it's a popular time, I don't know. But anyway, I don't choose it. But I am going to go to Cork, though, in Southern Ireland, in Erra. And if I'd had my way, I would be playing Dublin and Belfast, too.
Well, look, the new album is called Just Fabulous Rock and Roll. 43 studio albums later, 6 soundtracks, 35 compilation albums, 6 gospel albums, 10 live albums, 139 singles. Pleasure to speak to you today, sir. Thank you.
Stephen, thank you very much for your time and your interest.
It's better to dream of you. The twilight sees me.